Good day, and welcome to the briefing on the new IRS recommendations on equivalency. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Elizabeth Sullivan. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, and hello, everyone, and welcome to our conference call briefing. My name is Liz Sullivan, and I am the Managing Director for Corporate, Independent, and Family Philanthropy here at the Council on Foundations. It's a pleasure to moderate today's discussion, and thank you for your participation. As you all know, on September 24th, the Internal Revenue Service proposed long-awaited regulatory changes that significantly modify regulations on equivalency determination and cross-border grant-making. The proposal by the IRS is a result of many years of work on the part of the Council on Foundations, TechSoup Global, and key allies, including many council members, to create a more conducive environment for cross-border grant-making by U.S. private foundations and public charities. While additional work remains to be done before our sector can claim full victory on this issue, the announcement by the IRS, which was championed in recent remarks by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton during the Clinton Global Initiative, is a very positive step in the right direction towards simplifying rules for cross-border grant-making. In the near future, the Council on TechSoup Global hope to be able to launch NGO Source, an equivalency determination service that will help U.S. grant makers streamline their international giving. Our call today will cover all of these topics. And again, thank you for joining us for this hour. We have just over 170 some odd of you on the line. Our first speaker today will be Jan Gallagher, General Counsel at the Council on Foundations. Jan will set the context for our discussion, providing background on how the Council came to take on this effort on behalf of our globally engaged members, and on what has transpired thus far. We'll then turn over to Mark Owens of Kaplan and Drysdale, who has been an essential resource in the carrying out of this effort from the beginning. Mark will provide an analysis of the IRS announcement and what its immediate implications for the sector are. Mark is also joined by his colleague at Kaplan and Drysdale, Michael Durham, who's available here as a resource to our discussion. We'll then hear from Sheila Warren, an attorney who graduated from Harvard Law School and is an expert in tax-exempt law. As director of NGO Source from TechSoup Global in San Francisco, Sheila will provide an update on NGO Source, the first-ever equivalency determination service made possible by the IRS announcement. Finally, Mark will discuss next steps for ensuring the most positive outcome from the IRS on this important issue for global grant makers. We will then open our conversation up for questions and comments from you, our audience. At the appropriate time, I'll invite those of you to queue up by punching in your keypad, *1. And I'll repeat those instructions again when the time comes. Please note again that this briefing is being recorded, and links to access it will be posted on both the Council and NGO Source websites. And since this is an open call, we encourage you to follow us on Twitter, at #INTLGM. With that, to get us started, I'd now like to welcome our first speaker, Jan Gallagher, General Counsel at the Council on Foundations, who again will set the context for today's discussion. Jan.
Thank you, Liz, and good afternoon or morning, everyone. The reason why we're here today has its roots in a revenue procedure that the Internal Revenue Service issued back in 1992. That revenue procedure allows private foundations to make determinations that a foreign grantee is the equivalent of a U.S. public charity, and if they follow the steps outlined in the revenue procedure, they are protected by a safe harbor if they've made those determinations in good faith. That was a real step forward in 1992, but it meant that each foundation that wanted to make a grant to any particular grantee outside the United States had to make its own determination, and that caused people to be doing duplicate determinations. One private foundation would want to make a grant to grantee X, then another private foundation would want to make a grant to the same grantee. They'd have to go through the same steps. It was costly and inefficient. Our members began asking us whether we couldn't do something about this to make the process more efficient and more streamlined and less costly. So back in 2006, with a grant, an initial grant from the General Electric Foundation, the council began to explore whether there was sufficient interest in our membership to take on as a project, asking the Internal Revenue Service for guidance that would allow all foundations to rely on determinations made by a single entity. We began that work with an advisory group of about 25 of our members who do a lot of international grant making. And the conclusion that we reached was that there was, in fact, strong interest in trying to streamline this process. As a consequence, we moved forward in 2007 with an introductory meeting with the Internal Revenue Service to explore whether there was support there or might be support there for an approach to ask them to provide guidance on having a central body make these equivalency determinations. The initial response we got from the Internal Revenue Service was favorable, and so we proceeded with the next step, which was for the council to find a partner to actually do these equivalence determinations. We issued a request for proposals in April of 2008. We got two proposals back, and our committee looked over those proposals and selected TechSoup Global to be our partner. In 2009, TechSoup Global submitted a request to the Internal Revenue Service for a private letter ruling. It was an extensive and well-documented request, and led to discussions between TechSoup Global and the Internal Revenue Service. Unfortunately, it became apparent that the Internal Revenue Service was not inclined to rule favorably on that private letter ruling request. So at that point, we decided to take a different tack and instead to approach the Treasury Department's Tax Policy Office with a request for them to revise and update Revenue Procedure 9294. We submitted in January 2010 a proposal to Treasury Tax Policy to amend and update Revenue Procedure 9294. Since 2010, we've had several meetings with Treasury Tax Policy staff, with staff at the IRS Chief Counsel's Office, and with Internal Revenue Service personnel. In 2011, the Treasury Department added revisions to Revenue Procedure 9294 to its priority guidance plan. And in 2012, the State Department showed some interest in this project. The result of all of this work and all of these meetings and all of these submissions trying to explain what we were doing and trying to respond to objections that people had when confronted with what is a somewhat novel approach on the part, at least of the Internal Revenue Service, the culmination of all of that is the proposed regulation that was issued 2 weeks ago. I'm going to leave it to Mark to discuss that proposal in some detail, but I do want to recognize before I turn it over to Mark the tremendous leadership that Rob Buchanan of the Council and his successor John Harvey have had in taking this proposal from the germ of an idea back in 2006 and getting us to this favorable point in 2012. And I also want to thank the funders. We've had generous support from a number of our members in keeping this project going. And again, without their help, we would not have been able to get to where we are today. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Mark.
Okay, good afternoon or good morning, as the case may be. I'm going to describe the proposed regulation that Treasury issued, as Jan said, about 2 weeks ago. It is a proposed regulation, but at the same time, in the preamble to the regulation, the Treasury Department indicated that taxpayers could rely on the regulation now, even before it is finalized. And there is a 90-day comment period during which any interested individuals can submit comments. And once those comments have been assimilated, and if there is a request for a hearing, the hearing will occur, and after that hearing, the regulation will be ready for finalization. But Treasury does indicate that taxpayers can rely on the regulation now. The proposals that we had placed in front of the IRS and Treasury, that Jan referenced, had approached the equivalency determination process from the standpoint of defining a concept of essentially a library, a repository for equivalency determinations, how those determinations would be developed, and then a mechanism by which the IRS could approve them, approve the repository as a source of reliance documents. Now, what Treasury did in this proposed regulation, though, is take a different approach. We feel comes out at essentially the same place, albeit with a somewhat broader sweep. And by broader sweep, I mean that the regulations did not focus on equivalency determinations per se. What the regulations focused on is that concept in Revenue Procedure 92-94 and in the regulations under Section 4945, that taxpayers, that private foundations can rely on an opinion of counsel that a foreign grantee is the equivalent of a U.S. charity. And that reliance on counsel, or in the alternative, an affidavit of the grantee, is where the regulations focus. And what they do is expand the concept of reliance on the advice of an attorney to include reliance on the advice of a tax practitioner authorized to practice before the Internal Revenue Service pursuant to Circular 230. Circular 230 is the document that sets out what are essentially ethics rules, rules of process and procedure that govern the standards of practice before the Internal Revenue Service. And there are certain categories of practitioners, attorneys and certified public accountants can practice before the Internal Revenue Service based on that credential. There's also a category of enrolled agents who are persons who have passed an examination to practice before the IRS. Those three groups of individuals, for other purposes in the code, are appropriate sources of advice on interpretation of tax law. And in various provisions, their advice can provide protection from imposition of penalties and things of that nature. So what Treasury did is expand that definition of advice of counsel to include these other categories of advisors. And that's pretty much what the regulation does. Now, the implications of that, though, are important. One of the roadblocks that had been faced by organizations seeking to more broadly utilize opinions of counsel under Revenue Procedure 92-94 had been this idea that an opinion of counsel requires an attorney-client relationship. In order to rely on a lawyer's advice, you have to be the client of the lawyer. And so that creates complications if you're going to essentially use the same advice, have multiple clients rely on it. There are some pretty significant hurdles in the way tax law, or the way the practice of law occurs in the United States that make that a difficult proposition. Now, for accountants and enrolled agents, however, you don't have that need for an attorney-client privilege. So the ability to rely on the advice of those other categories of individuals is a far easier hurdle to overcome. So where things stand with this regulation is that it now allows the concept of a repository to exist without having that need to struggle with how to make an opinion of counsel issued to one client more broadly applicable. We no longer have to struggle with the attorney-client relationship. So as a result, this proposed regulation provides a pretty firm building block for the creation of an equivalency determination repository. It pretty much gets us to where we want to be without using the phraseology of a repository, but it sets out the legal framework under which advice can be given broadly that a number of organizations can rely on. There are a number of other, procedural aspects that would need to be put together or included in order to get a repository off the ground. You need to think about the nature of the document that the repository user would receive. And in informal discussions with Treasury Department and in reviewing the standards for advice under Circular 230, it's pretty clear that the quantum of advice, the nature of the reliance document, does not have to be in the same form and to the same extent as written advice of counsel. In other words, it appears that the document upon which grantmakers could rely could provide a high-level overview of the facts so that a particular foundation grantmaker could know, for example, that Cambridge University was a university that did have a regularly enrolled body of students and a faculty, and a conclusion that the institution qualified as, could qualify the school under Section 170B1A2 if it was a U.S. entity. The legal analysis would not need to be anywhere near as extensive or expansive as an opinion of counsel would contain. So the framework is there to follow that sort of high-level statement of facts and conclusion, have that operate as a document on which multiple foundations can rely, multiple grant makers, and thus that piece of the process of making international grants can be streamlined. There would, of course, still need to be the usual other pieces of due diligence that would be necessary. But as far as the equivalency determination process goes, it looks like this regulation, coupled with the standards for advice under Circular 230, gets us to where we want to be. And that's kind of a summary of the guidance in a nutshell.
Great. Thank you so much, Mark. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Sheila Warren, who is the director of NGO Source for Technical Global. And Sheila will offer an update on NGO Source, which, as mentioned earlier, is the first of its kind equivalency determination service made possible by the IRS announcement. Sheila.
Thanks, Liz, and good morning and afternoon, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today. As Liz and Jen and Mark have all noted, NGOSOURCE is a joint project of the Council on Foundations and TechSoup Global. And in a nutshell, what it does is it takes the incredibly complex world of equivalency determinations, or EDs as we call them, and attempts to streamline and simplify it in a way that really maximizes its ability to scale and take advantage of the incredible knowledge of the sector. So with this guidance, we're really thrilled that we can now offer you this service. As Mark noted, the hesitation in launching prior was that there was this ambiguity around whether, even though NGOSOURCE is led by attorneys, namely me, it was unclear if without a formal attorney-client relationship between me and NGOSOURCE and a foundation, whether we could issue this guidance and have it be as binding as an opinion issued by legal counsel at, say, a law firm or in-house at a particular foundation. This guidance, as Mark noted, does clear up that question entirely and pave the way for the launch of this service. Now, anyone who's done an ED knows that the legal analysis, while quite complicated, is only one piece of what needs to be involved. Another very complicated piece is how to get the information. So back in 2007, 2008, when the council did an extensive survey of the sector, asking both foundation leaders, grants managers, NGO leaders, thousands of different individuals around the world about their views on this topic, one of the main hesitations and difficulties in using ED was obtaining the information needed, that factual basis that Mark mentioned, upon which a legal analysis is done. And just as a quick refresher for those of you who may not know the details of equivalency determination, what it is essentially an application of U.S. tax law, the same tax law principles that are applied to public charities in the United States to foreign NGOs. So it looks at the circumstances, the facts, the operations, the governing documents, the financials, really reams of information about NGOs, and looks at that through a lens of U.S. tax law. That is, if that NGO were on U.S. soil, would it qualify as a 501c3 public charity? Now, as you might imagine, that analysis is complicated. As I noted, getting the information is very challenging. One of the reasons TechSoup was chosen by the council to be its partner in is because we have a global network of partners around the world. So we are able to provide NGOs guidance in their language, in their time zone, to explain really complex tax law concepts like dissolution clauses, electioneering and campaign activity, lobbying, are you doing it, how much are you doing? These are all the kinds of questions that NGOs need to be able to address in their factual responses to questions asked in order for us to do the analysis to determine whether or not they are, in fact, equivalent. So the beauty of NGOSOURCE is that it's been built and designed since 2009 when we were selected. So these processes happened in parallel. The entire request scheme for regulatory change that Jan noted, at the same time, we decided to build and design this repository. That involved extensive surveying of grant makers. We have an advisory council comprised of small and large foundation grant makers and donor-advised funds and other charitable givers in space who are able to actually tell us what the sector really needs. What are the pain points? What's so difficult about this? What is going to be the most helpful thing to do? The mandate is to benefit the entire sector, not just the large foundations, not just the small foundations. It's really to reduce the burden on both grant makers and on their grantees. In anticipation of this guidance, we have been gearing up for launch. We were really hopeful that something would come down. We are pleased to note that it turns out that this is the guidance we were, not precisely the guidance we were hoping for in the sense that the term repository, as noted, was not used. However, as Mark indicated, we do feel that this has opened a very wide door. It's very clear now that any qualified tax practitioner, including one housed at a repository like NGOSOURCE, is free to issue this guidance and conduct these EDs on behalf of foundations. I'll keep my remarks quickly to get to, short to get to questions, but I will preempt one question, which I'm sure will be asked, about the launch date. And I will say that we haven't announced a formal launch date yet, and I encourage you, if that interests you, to go to www.ngosource.org and sign up for our newsletter. We'll be updating both that website and our newsletter mailing list with information about launch. The minute that we finalize a date, the whole sector will be aware of that via those portals and lists.
Great. Thank you so much, Sheila, for that overview. And in addition to kind of keeping an eye on the potential launch date through the NGOSYS newsletter, I'd now like to ask Mark to kind of conclude our speaker presentation to speak a little bit about the next steps for ensuring the most positive outcome from the IRS on this important issue.
Okay, I'd be happy to. There are a couple of next steps. One, there is going to be the, you know, a set of decisions that TechSoup Global will be making about its EDIR piece. In terms of the regulation itself, as I indicated, as drafted, it provides a very good building block for an EDIR. It could be given even greater strength in that regard by the inclusion of an example or two. It remains to be seen whether the Treasury Department would be receptive to an example, or whether their preference would be to quickly finalize this relatively clean regulation. So I think the next step from the standpoint of the Treasury Department is to have a conversation with Treasury, with Ruth Madrigal, to see about the level of Treasury interest in examples or in other adjustments that we might desire. For example, in the preamble, Treasury did ask for comments on a number of potential issues, including, for example, whether U.S. grant makers could be entitled to continue to rely on affidavits of foreign counsel or on affidavits from the grantees themselves. And I think what is underlying Treasury's concern there is that foreign counsel and foreign grantees may not be particularly familiar with U.S. tax law. And in fact, there may be language barriers. There may be all sorts of issues with the level at which that sort of a foreign sourced advice should be considered appropriate for reliance. So it may well be that from a tax law standpoint, that Treasury is going to want to know what the sector thinks about those sorts of comments. So there are a set of issues that deal with potentially making the proposed regs a better building block for EDIRs, and then there are a set of questions that exist sort of independent of that, that go to the use of affidavits, the use of advice on foreign counsel, questions of that sort. And so there are a few steps to go through to determine whether the council and the sector more broadly wants to comment, or whether they're happy with letting Treasury make their own calls on those particular points and moving forward with the reg as it's drafted.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Very helpful. So at this point, we will open it up for Q&A and really use the remaining of our time to hear from you all, from the audience, for questions for Jan, Mark, Sheila. So just as a reminder, please dial *1 to be put into the queue to ask questions. And I'll ask the operator, Alicia, at this point, if we have any individuals in line.
Yes, ma'am. We'll go first to Jeannie McGowan from Fidelity.
Great. Hi, Jeannie. Jeannie, are you on the line?
Hi, this is Jeannie. I actually didn't have a question. I apologize.
Oh, okay. No problem. Thanks for joining us. Alicia, do we have any additional folks in the line for questions?
Yes, we'll go next to Helena Kalenda from Lewis Foundation.
Hi.
Hi.
My question had to do with if you could comment on the relationship between this equivalency determination and expenditure responsibility.
Great question. Sheila or Mark, would you be willing to give us a quick overview of the differences?
Sure.
Go ahead, Mark.
Sorry. Equivalency determination is where the need for formal expenditure responsibility is bypassed because the recipient of the grant is the equivalent of a domestic U.S. that is a U.S. publicly supported charity. The expenditure responsibility rules apply where the grantee is not an equivalent of a publicly supported U.S. Charity, and thus there's a need for a contractual agreement to ensure that the funds are used for charitable purposes in the hands of the recipient, that there's a need for a pre-grant review, and a need for a reporting mechanism on the back end to ensure funds have been used appropriately. So the expenditure responsibility process involves considerably more administrative action and consequent cost. It's in short more paper intensive and more resource intensive than the use of an equivalency determination.
Sheila, did you care to comment regarding NGO source and the focus on equivalency determination?
Sure. Yeah, we focused on equivalency determination as a result of the survey that came back. So it was made clear to us by participants in that survey that while there was both a predominance of ED and ER, and I think, as Mark sort of alluded, there are really good reasons why you'd pick one or the other. ED is never the only answer. ER should also be part of the grantmaker's toolkit. And there's more information about this on the ngosource.org webpage. But it was made clear that in a pinch, and if ED were easier to do, grantmakers would prefer ED simply because it allows for grants to be made in a more conducive manner over a period of time, as opposed to all the reporting back that ER requires.
Terrific. Thanks. Alicia, additional questions in the queue, please.
Yes, ma'am. We'll go next to Susan Powell from Foundations for the National Institutes of Health.
We are a public charity rather than a private foundation, so we have a little bit more leeway in how we deal with our foreign grants, but we tend to be pretty conservative in how we deal with making sure foreign organizations are eligible for our grant money. So my question is, does this proposed regulation make any changes to how public charities can make foreign grants?
Mark, would you like to address that question?
Sure. I'll answer. What it does is it provides a mechanism for giving any U.S. grant maker greater assurance that a particular grant is going to be used exclusively for charitable purposes, because the process of making an equivalency determination involves a review of the organizing document to ensure there's a charitable purpose involved. It involves a determination that there will be no excessive lobbying activity, no political campaign activity. A determination that the U.S. entity, or the foreign entity, is going to have a process in place so that if it ever goes out of business, its assets are going to continue to be devoted to charitable purposes. Basically, it encompasses a number of bells and whistles that are going to help a public charity in the United States build the record that any grant it makes to a foreign entity is going to indeed be used appropriate for appropriate charitable purposes. Now, the rules governing expenditures to foreign entity grants to foreign entities by publicly supported charities are not as clearly enunciated as they are as they are for private foundations. But there are a lot of similarities when you begin to piece together a variety of revenue rulings. So this regulation would be a help to both publicly supported charities and private foundations.
This is Michael Durham. Just to echo that point, in remarks yesterday given to the D.C. Bar Association, Ruth Madrigal at Treasury acknowledged that, you know, because these regulations for expenditure responsibility are only addressed to private foundations, they had only specifically discussed private foundations in this revised guidance. But she acknowledged that other organizations, including, for instance, donor-advised funds, in the absence of regulations specifically addressed to them, it would be appropriate for them to make reasonable judgments about the law that applies to them by looking to these analogous private foundation rules.
Great. Thank you to you both. Alicia, we'll take the next question, please.
We'll go next to Jordan Kramer from Planned Parenthood Federation of America.
Great. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks for holding this call. My question is, we currently have a 90-day comment period on this, and proposed rules asked a few questions, and I was wondering if we, as a sector, have sort of decided what the best answers to the question of if there should be a time limit, if affidavits should still be considered from the grantee, and that the idea of there being a certain dollar threshold for the use of affidavits.
Mark, would you like to address that one?
This is Jan Gallagher, and let me just say that I don't think we've reached any conclusions yet on what our responses are to those questions. I would certainly not want to see an outcome in which private foundations became unable to rely on affidavits from foreign grantees, and I think that's going to be a key point in any comments that the Council will make.
This is Sheila, and we agree completely. I mean, I don't think, just based on the feedback initially, whether it's, you know, online on Twitter or whether it's in blogs or whatnot, you know, I don't think anybody's in favor of a reduction in the use of affidavits or a limitation on the use of affidavits, and that's certainly true for NGO Source and TechSoup Global as well. So while there hasn't really been a convening of commentary, I think that it's quite safe to say that that's the general feeling, and it's a matter, I think, of the extent to which how and the extent to which it's articulated by various commenters.
This is Michael Durham. Just to reflect again on comments made yesterday by Ruth Madrigal of Treasury, in response to a question, she did confirm that if they were to make a change to kind of the current regulation, which kind of lists affidavits as something that one can ordinarily rely on, that they certainly are not intending to remove affidavits entirely. I think the thought was that they would look to the general principle of the good faith standard to see, you know, whether in a particular context an affidavit would be, if it was in good faith to rely on that, or whether there are situations in which affidavits, an organization might know that an affidavit is faulty and should not be reliable. So certainly I think there's room to comment and to reaffirm the importance of affidavits to the grant-making community, but I thought that was useful perspective on what the government was thinking about.
Very good. Thank you, Michael. We'll take the next question, please, Alicia.
We'll go next to Ruth Maurice from Hewlett Foundation.
Hi. I wondered if you thought that the final regs will provide or should be asked to provide any additional guidance on the actual reliance periods for equivalents of educational institutions and public charities. I know that they gave sort of a 12-month example in the proposed regs. Do you think they'll expand on that?
This is Mark. Yeah, I think this is one of those questions that we have, we have yet to focus in on in terms of specificity. I think there's a 12-month reliance period is sort of a minimum amount. It would be good to have a longer period, particularly since communicating with foreign grantees is going to take some time, and you may have issues regarding accounting periods and how those fit together. So I would think that careful consideration should be given, but no less than 12 months, I think, would be a good outcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Alicia, next question, please.
We'll go next to Dave Lindbergh from Council of Michigan Foundation.
Thank you. I'm just curious, based on the comment period, which I see ends December 24th, when would Jan or Mark expect us to see final regulations?
Oh, around the 12th, but never.
To a certain extent, that's going to depend on how many comments we receive and whether there's a request for a hearing. If there's a request for a hearing, that's going to, extend at a minimum. It'll push the length of time out probably well into 2013. If there's no request for a hearing and no significant comments, that is, no comments that point out serious flaws in the proposed regulation, it sort of goes into a general stream for finalization. It's going to be impacted by things like other regulations projects that are flowing through the same narrow pipeline. Now, that having been said, as it currently stands, this is a pretty simple regulation. All it does is essentially incorporate a set of Circular 230 standards into a regulatory standard that was narrower. So it's not cutting a lot of serious new ground from a tax administration standpoint, and it could be, as a result, finalized more quickly than regulations normally are. But, regulations can take years to be finalized. So Jan's comment about the 12th of November is only partly in jest. Go ahead, Jan. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that the fact that foundations are allowed to rely on the proposal makes it somewhat less likely that they'll be in a hurry to get to a final, since the relief people were seeking is already in place.
Great. Thank you very much. Next question, please, Alicia.
We'll go next to Dana Perry from Global Green Grants Fund.
Hi. Hi, how are you? We actually already had our question answered. We were curious about how the regulations would affect public charities who manage donor-advised funds. So thank you very much.
Very good. Terrific. Next question, please.
We'll go next to Baron Barnett from Give to Asia.
Good morning. My question has already been answered as well. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks so much. Next question, please.
I'll go next to Jill Baldassar from the Dayton Foundation.
I'll turn this over to my associate.
Hi, this is Diane Timmons. I'm in charge of the grants program here at the Dayton Foundation. I'm trying to understand, in the United States, our charities have to complete a 990 each year that we can rely on, that they have used the money properly, in addition to the reports we require, but they do file the 990. So am I hearing that there would be something that the foreign organizations would file each year that would substantiate the money they received from U.S. charities?
Can I ask Jan to address that reporting requirement?
Hi, Diane. No, a foreign charity without any U.S. sourced income would not have to file a Form 990. You would, if you wanted to look at their financials, there's financial information required as part of the affidavit process, and you would need to look at that information if you wanted to do your own evaluation rather than relying on a determination, for example, by NGO source.
Okay, so NGO source will certify that they are an equivalency of a U.S. charity. Then you make the grant, but then after that, there's no follow-up by NGO source to determine use of money or subsequent grants.
Well, I think that's the reason why you saw the IRS in the notice of proposed rulemaking ask what the reliance period should be.
That's what I was wondering. Okay. So there'll be a period of time. Okay.
That's right. And let me just add to that. You know, we glanced on this topic, but you know, there is certainly other diligence required by a grant maker. An NGO source, we like to say, is really about how to make a grant, not whether to make a grant. So, and I know this is a bit tangential to your question, but just to make the point that, you know, things like OFAC anti-terrorism compliance, things like charitable mission fit, and just general diligence on a grantee for the purposes of robustness and that kind of thing are still a responsibility of a grant maker, and we encourage those grant makers to educate themselves about those laws and can help grant makers with that education. What we do is really weigh in on the tax law question of whether equivalency determination is an option for the grant or whether a grant maker either needs to use essential responsibility or not make the grant at all. So I do think the question of the reliance period, I do agree with Jan that that's why the IRS has that question outstanding as to what the reliance period and the length of time would be. And NGO source does intend at the close of that reliance period, whatever it winds up being, to either go to the grantee, the NGO rather, and seek updated information or ask the grant maker if they would like that information and that reliance period to be extended and renewed. So that would be an option with the service. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And may I ask one more thing? Will there be a fee for the NGO service, and if so, how will that be determined?
It's a great question. It's all on the website. There's a pricing page that talks about membership exactly. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much. Thanks, Sheila. We can get through a few more questions before we conclude at the top of the hour. So, Alicia, if there are any more questions, let's receive them, please.
We'll go next to Helena Kalenda from Luce Foundation.
Hi. Hello, am I there?
Okay.
Thanks. The clarification on the fee is helpful, and I'll check the website, but and maybe this other information is there as well. But is it going to be something like a guide star where if an organization has already been cleared through NGO source, a foundation could go and look to find that on the website. And if not, then would the foundation request from NGO source that this ED be done?
Sheila, would you like to address that?
Yeah. Absolutely, and that's a really great question, and thank you for asking. It does function that way, and I wouldn't draw the analogy to GuideStar myself, but I think there is an axis on which that they are very, very similar. The goal of the repository is really to reduce that duplication of effort that Jan mentioned in her early remarks. So when a foundation comes to NGO Source and we do an ED on a grantee, for that reliance period, that grantee will retain that eligibility, if you will, that ED status as certified. And another foundation or a subsequent foundation that would come would be informed that that NGO already had that status. Now, again, when the reliance period ends, either we'll do a renewal, which is at a much lower fee, or we will the ED may lapse. If enough years pass, the ED will lapse, and we'll have to do a brand new ED all over again, let's say 3 years down the line or whatever down the line time period. And that time period will be determined by the reliance. so it is very similar.
Great. Thank you so much. I think we have time for a couple more questions. Alicia, next question, please.
We'll go next to Mary Beth Gallagher from the William Hinman Foundation.
Hi, how are you? I have a little bit of a legal question, and I'm trying to understand, first, if anyone can submit a legal opinion, and second, how the attorney-client privilege for other matters unrelated to the ED are affected by that.
Jan, can you address this one, please?
I'm going to let Mark take this one.
I apologize. Mark, go ahead.
Okay. The attorney-client relationship really isn't affected by either the proposed reg or the equivalency determination process. You know, it is still possible. It will always be the case that a U.S. grant maker can go to an attorney who is subject to Circular 230, get an opinion of counsel, and move forward on that basis. So that relationship, the ability to rely on your own attorney's advice with all the privacy that goes with that, still stands and will stand no matter what happens to this particular regulation. I don't know if that answers your question precisely.
No, I guess not exactly. I'm just trying to understand if there could be any disincentive to sharing opinions or if everyone is open to sharing opinions.
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say the disincentive to sharing attorneys' opinions is that difficulty with the attorney-client relationship, and that is a matter of bar rules that apply outside the tax context. Generally, that someone can only rely on the advice of their own attorney and not on the advice that some other attorney gave to someone else. So it's you're still going to have that conundrum with the reliance on an attorney's advice here as opposed to reliance on other practitioners.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we're close to the top of the hour, and in closing, I just wanted to ask very quickly, Mark, Jan, and Sheila, what can participants on this call do over the next few months to help advance this effort?
Well, this is Jan, and I would welcome any thoughts that anyone on the call has about what the Council's comment should be in response to the questions that the Internal Revenue Service has asked.
And I'll share an email address with folks in a moment as to how to channel some of that input. Mark or Sheila, any final comments?
From our standpoint, again, we really encourage people to sign up for the newsletter and check out the website. Do a lot of communication via the newsletter list, and certainly if we feel, as we come to a conclusion about certain pieces, that we'd like perhaps to see included in comments, we'll be putting them through that list or on the website itself. So so there can be some sort of consonants in the comments that are sent.
Very good. Thank you. Mark, you're breaking up a little bit on our end. Would you mind just repeating very quickly? Oh, we may have lost him on the line.
Yeah.
But in any case, we are just about to wrap up here. So let me just thank our speakers. For those of you who actually, before I do that, if you didn't have a chance today to ask a question or share a comment online, we welcome you to do so by emailing us. And please do that through John Harvey, who Jan mentioned earlier, our Managing Director for Global Philanthropy here at the Council. John has been working very closely with Jan, Mark, and Sheila on this project for the last year and a half or so, but unfortunately couldn't join us for today's call. And I know that John will be happy to be in touch with you and receive any questions or comments he may have. His email address is harvj@cof.org. Again, that's harvj@cof.org. And so let me just close by thanking all of our speakers, Dan Gallagher, Mark Owens, Sheila Warren, and Michael Durham as well, and all of you on the line today for your questions, comments, and participation. We hope you found this briefing valuable to your work and to your understanding of this important initiative. The Council on Foundations remains committed to doing what we can to ensure a positive environment for philanthropy, and we look forward to working with you on this and other efforts aimed at promoting a legislative and regulatory environment that will allow philanthropy to grow and to thrive. Thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
That does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.